just to kill you isn't enough for him.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Underrated Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss films that we think are underrated, underappreciated, or ones that have slipped under the radar and passed most people by. We are the Undercast Company, made up of myself, Derek McDuff, as well as my co-host Ariel Ortiz.
Hello.
And Alan Torres.
Hey, what's up everybody?
We are in the middle of a mini-series that we're doing focusing on underrated or forgotten films from before the 1970s, and today we're going to be taking a look at somewhat of a cult classic, a little brother, if you will, of Psycho and a proto-slasher. This was Alan's pick, and that is 1960's Peeping Tom. So Alan, why don't you take it away and tell us a little bit about this movie?
Oh yeah, and first off, I wanted to give a shout out. There's actually a recommendation by one of our listeners on the Discord. He reminded me of it, and I was like, oh my god, yes, I gotta do it. It's one of your buddies, right, Derek?
Yeah, my buddy Damien is one of our patrons over there on Discord, so we always appreciate that.
Big shout out. Thank you so much, Damien. I really appreciate it. Yeah, that, like, as soon as I read that, I was like, oh my god, yep, that's my pick, instantaneously. But yeah, so Peeping Tom, it's a 1960s psychological horror thriller, proto-slasher, like Derek was saying, directed by Michael Powell and then starring Carl Boehm and Moira Shearer. Yeah, so it came back in the day. The plot of the film is pretty much this dude, he's a Peeping Tom, voyeurism, whatever you want to call it, and he likes to murder women, and like he uses a camera. He films them and he kills them with the tripod. There's a blade at the end of the tripod. And there's a little bit more to it around the end of the film where you find out that he's actually also making his victims see themselves die. He puts like a little mirror on the camera just because he needs to see them frightened because of the things that happened to him in his youth. His dad was a scientist, but kind of like a huge dick and just completely traumatized the character Mark, our main character, we follow around and we see him do these things. But yeah, I want to hear what you guys thought. I had seen clips of it long time ago, and then I remember seeing it on like Bravo's top 100 scariest movie moments, and I remember I had put that on my watch list for the longest time, and I'm fucking super happy I finally got the chance to jump right into it. So yeah, what did you guys think?
I think definitely when you saying the like kind of like the brother to Psycho, I definitely get that, because it did feel very much like a very weird movie, interesting movie. it does have that feel of like a, which it kind of takes place in a British kind of time where in the mod era, which is kind of like what like The Who came out of and all those kind of things of that kind of style. And you get that kind of style from Mark himself. And then also with the kind of random dance number in the middle by one of his victims, very modish in its way. But yeah, now hearing that kind of idea of it being a kind of companion to Psycho, I definitely get that. It is that kind of like psychological character of like a very awkward but charming kind of guy. Definitely like something that nowadays, you know, you would be more aware and hesitant of like interacting with, and not really brush off. Like a lot of people in this movie kind of brush that off, even making comments of like, you know, you're weird, and I am kind of threatened by you, but I'm not, kind of thing. It's just very random. It's a very weird concept of a movie of this Peeping Tom, but it was definitely interesting to kind of like have this kind of background of a story of the father somewhat kind of morphing and creating him as a Peeping Tom in a way. It's kind of like the father himself kind of had voyeurism kind of tendencies, mm-hmm. but in a slightly different way, very much so just for his son. And in a very weird, like, yeah, like it's kind of like if psychology went wrong in a way. And I feel like that's where his whole, I don't want to say manifesto, but his whole goal of his film kind of like came from, like, essentially finishing what his father started in a way. But yeah, definitely a weird, interesting movie. I think, like, having, like, following this character himself, it gives you a feel of, like, being a voyeurist yourself as well. So that was, like, kind of, like, an interesting feeling to have while watching a movie. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with all that, Ariel. This is actually a movie that I wasn't even aware of until Damien suggested it. And then, you know, I looked it up and obviously, you know, I kind of brought up that it was, it has been kind of compared a lot to Psycho. They came out the same year. Both deal with somewhat of the similar themes of, like, this guy who's this introvert that is kind of has this tortured past that came out of being, you know, kind of tortured by their parents or, like, abused psychologically by their parents. And I think, you know, obviously over the years, Psycho has been the one that's been remembered, whereas this is more of a cult film. And at the time, it, you know, it was, a lot of people were very opposed, like, oh, there's all this, you know, stuff about sex and violence and all this stuff. And it came out in the era that I talked about before of the Hays Code, although the Hays Code was starting to become less and less prevalent. Filmmakers were starting to ignore it and really push the envelope with what they could do. And I think this is one of those films that really, like, was like, okay, we're going to technically be in the letter of the law of this code, but we're really going to push the boundaries. And I think that audiences of the time and critics of the time as well just kind of missed the boat, and it has had a real major reappraisal in a lot of ways, because this film feels like it came out in the 80s or the 90s. Like, it feels so ahead of its time with just the way it's shot and the themes and all of that stuff, the psychological profile of this guy, because you are like, wow, you can, on one hand, you feel sorry for him, but he's also, like, murdering women, and you're like, oh, he's a monster, but you feel for him, and you're kind of caught up in his kind of love interest. You're like, oh man, I want to like you, but are you horrible? And I really loved all of that stuff. Just all the stuff with the camera, I felt like, too, was really, really ahead of its time, how he's like, oh, I have to capture everything and record everything, and he's going everywhere with his camera, and now that's what everyone fucking does. Everyone goes and has to record everything and take pictures of everything, and we can't just experience things out in the world. And this was before, like, any of that was a thing. Like, it's amazing to me that this came out in 1960, because it feels like it is directly commenting on the things we are dealing with today. And him as a character, he feels just like someone that would be in, like, a David Fincher movie, or, like, you know, a Silence of the Lambs movie. Like, he'd be one of the ones that Clarice is coming after, or something like that. And so, yeah, I was really, really drawn into it. Like I said, it amazed me that this is from this time period. And the performances, I thought, were all really great. I think that his dedication to, like, oh, I've got to make the perfect film and all of this stuff, and this is this documentary I was making, almost served as, like, maybe a commentary about some of the directors at the time, which were notably these assholes who would just, like, kind of, like, just use and discard their stars and not really care about who they were hurting just so that they could get the perfect film. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it was something I definitely read a lot into it. And I know The Shining wouldn't come out till years later, but, you know, Kubrick was making films at this time. Hitchcock was making films at this time. You have these directors who are just so taxing on their stars, and they are kind of almost sociopathic in the way that this guy was. And it's like, oh, it's all for the greater good of making my great movie or my great documentary, and I don't care who I hurt or anything. So, yeah, this really, really had a big impact on me, and it's something that I want to go back to and revisit for sure.
Yeah, I have to disagree with you that it feels like there were a lot of movies at the time that had this kind of energy, I would say, and that kind of, like I said, the mod kind of film era Definitely had that kind of things. Like I had texted you guys about of Willy Wonka, the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which it takes place during this about time in the 60s, not really when the filming was done, but takes place during about this time of that kind of mod era of England. And this kind
of,
but like,
that came out in the 70s. A lot of those films,
but
I
just said
came
that
out in the 70s.
It takes place in the 60s, though.
I know. That's what I'm saying, though. Like, this came out during that time period. Like, came out actually in that time.
Oh, because you said that it feels more like an 80s movie.
A 70s or 80s. But, yeah, it definitely feels at least 10 years ahead of its time.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, like call out, like, that mod era of movie telling that does get swept under the rug. Like, a lot of the mod kind of culture, you know, outside of the Who, has gotten hit, but it is that kind of like idea of like a somewhat counterculture of an era in this time, and I guess that's definitely like where this movie existed in. I mean, and I'm sure that that's where like culture kind of thing. I'm it also probably it being a more British film kept it limited its distribution in a way as well that kind of contributed to it. But yeah, definitely like, I think it, for me, the Mark character was just very much of like a stunted kind of unremorsed guy. I didn't really feel too much sympathy for him just because like, he just is a stunted person that doesn't know any better. He's a psychopath. And like, I think that the way that this movie and Psycho particularly differ is because you get that twist and that turn of Norman Bates like as the last thing. So up until that point you have a very sympathetic kind of character, whereas this is like, okay, his crime is presented like in the forefront, so his ability, the audience's ability to feel sympathy might have been like kind of stunted in that direction in a bit, but definitely, yeah, like you're saying, like feels like a Alfred Hitchcock or a Kubrick movie, and I think maybe just the notoriety that those directors and writers, kind of filmmakers, kind of gain causes this one to kind of be a bit more cultish in flavor.
Yeah, I mean, I know you got to talk, Alan, but before I get to you, I do think you bring up a good point about, you know, those guys, this was the era when people started lifting up these quote-unquote auteurs. So it's like, oh, this is where the French auteur theory came out. They're like, okay, well, here's a Kubrick, here's, you know, a Hitchcock. These are these great filmmakers. And if you're not one of those guys, even if you make a masterpiece, you're not going to get remembered. And also, you know, I think you bring up a really good point about the mod culture, something that I didn't really think of. Is that, yeah, this movie is a British film. And British films were kind of ahead of American films. And in what they were saying, in the way they were pushing the envelope, and you wouldn't see, like you said, until like the 70s and stuff with the Willy Wonkas, these kind of like not exactly counterculture films, but films that are really trying to do something with the craft, because so many films around the world, Britain, Soviet Union, Japan, stuff like that, they, Sweden, of course, with, you know, you've got all the masters, quote unquote, the masters from there, were really able to push the envelope in a way where they weren't suppressed as much by the Hays Code. And when it would come out in America, it would get suppressed, and that's why it was forgotten. But when they were making them in their home countries, they were able to do a lot more things. So I think that's a really valid point, Ariel.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But before I get into it, what is mod culture? What is that supposed to be?
So, you know, like the Who?
Yeah, I fucking hate them, but yeah.
Okay. But for example, for in this movie, like, they kind of like Mark's style essentially is like kind of like, that winter coat kind of look. He rides like a scooter. Ironically, in recent history, in the Book of Boba Fett, that gang, that colorful gang. You know those are mods.
I feel like those are more like American graffiti. Like those are more American mods are like
mods.
Like
I see that American graffiti is more so like the American motorcycle where
yeah, that's what I felt like mods those are more. Guys.
They drove mods scooters. They weren't motorcycles. They were scooters, mod scooters.
I don't know. I feel like yeah, they're fantasy vehicles. I don't know. I feel like maybe I don't know. To me, they felt more like American graffiti esque. Like
I think the audience could correct whichever one, but I'm pretty sure they were influenced by mod characters.
I mean, I've heard a lot of people saying that it's, I mean, this is like off topic, but like, I think it was like because George Lucas did American Graffiti, it was a callback to that. But Alan, did you ever watch Teen Titans?
Yeah, of course.
Do you remember Mad Mod?
Oh my God. Okay. So is it like
what mods are?
Okay, so it's kind of like, I mean, I'm probably wrong. It's not like Austin Powers kind
of.
Somewhat. Not,
they've got that. Yeah. A lot of times they have that bowl haircut, you know?
Like yeah,
you see him, like Ringo Starr or some shit.
Okay, so I kind of have some familiarity with it. Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. So, anyways, to get right into it, I love the hell out of this movie, and I will say I kind of disagree a little bit that like he was a complete psychopath because his character reminded me a lot of like in psychology. There's I can't remember his name. But they kind of did an experiment on a kid where they kind of conditioned him to be afraid of rabbits, where they would, you know, he was a baby and they would put, I wonder if maybe they took the study and were influenced by the study and put it in the movie as kind of like his arc, where they would put a rabbit near this little kid. And then whenever he got near the rabbit, they would scare the shit out of him. They would make like a really loud noise or something. And it ended up conditioning him to have like fear of rabbits.
Pavlov kind
of. Yeah, Pavlov's dog kind of thing. Exactly. And so I kind of felt like his dad was kind of doing an experiment on him where I feel like at the start, you do feel like you're like, damn, this guy's like a psychopath. But over time, you get to know his story a little bit more. And you're like, I feel like he's very sympathetic where I kind of feel very bad about it. And he was kind of planning his like suicide like over time in the film he's kind of bringing it up that he's like I know how this is going to end. I don't want to tell you the ending to my documentary when he tells the other filmmaker character when they're getting questioned by the police. And I thought that was really interesting that like at the end he didn't want to kill the love interest. Her name escaped me, but yeah, like even then he was like I don't want to look at you, because this whole thing for the audience is that he kind of loses control when the person is frightened, when they're scared. So they're like, so he kind of gets into that like killer mode kind of thing. And he keeps making her look away. And like, there is like heart to him. Like he's not, you know, like a stone cold killer or something like, which I'm pretty sure these other films were probably influenced by this one, like Maniac, the original and the remake, and Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. So those were like where the serial killers, like the main character, and you follow them around kind of thing. So I feel like this was way ahead of its time as well, like Derek was saying. But I felt like his character, I felt super bad for him. And like you could, and the thing is that Mark, the actor, just absolutely killed it. Mm-hmm. I love how he was so good at conveying this, like you feel sympathetic and you feel so like not bad for him, but you're just kind of like, he's kind of adorable. He's kind of shy at everything. And like, it seems like he wants to be around people and he wants to make friends, but he knows in the back of his mind that he has this like dark side to him and he didn't want it. It wasn't like something he wanted to do. It's kind of like in psychology where like some people just get, unfortunately, I know there's going to be a little, you know, trigger warning, but unfortunately with like, you know, pedophiles, it's usually comes from an abuser. So someone abused that person as a kid, and then they have kids, and then they abuse their kid, and they do these horrible things to them, and then that child kind of keeps the cycle going. So, you know, I'm not trying to say like, you know, he's in that same aspect, but I'm more saying like I felt bad for him. Like, I actually kind of wanted him to get out alive, and I wanted his love interest to, like, be able to pull him out of it, like, to redeem him in some way. But he's still a killer, and he still did these horrible things because they're still pretty vindictive and disturbing to the sense. And I'm pretty sure audiences at the time were probably like, whoa, this is, like, horrible. And I think, too, serial killers and, like, true crime stuff didn't really get into the bigger picture until way later on. You know, there's all these true crime podcasts and documentaries and stuff now, and there are all these things that took place from, like, the 50s all the way to the 90s. So for audiences back then, that was probably truly frightening to think that somebody can follow you around with a camera and just stalk you. And, you know, voyeurism was probably not really something general audiences knew. So I can see why, like, it probably bothered a lot of critics and audiences back in the day, where they're just like, this is fucked up. Like, it was probably, like, just way too graphic for them. And I'm kind of glad, though, it has, like, a following and a cult, and it's considered a cult classic, because I feel like there's a lot to it. Like you guys were saying, it's very ahead of its time. And I feel like this is one of the big slasher influences. It has to at this point, because it kind of has the same tropes and everything. But it's funny that even though it's ahead of its time, it kind of somehow gets around all the bullshit 80s kind of style, where it's like summer camp and sex and all this stuff, you know, all the shitty fun slasher shit we love. But back then, I felt like they actually tried to make, like, a really great story that was dark and disturbing, but it was like, I felt like it was like a character study too at the same time. But again, like, his character, the actor, he just portrayed him so well, because you know what it was? It's his eyes. You can see his smile and the way he talks. That's what gets you feeling like you can be around him and you feel safe around him. But his eyes tell even more. That's where it's the complete, like, 50-50. Like, there's a good side to him, and then there's a bad side. But unfortunately, like, his eyes are the big tell that he's... the darkness is still there, and he just can't control it. And, you know, even... and he tried to get help. He actually talked to the psychologist, which kind of made me laugh, because I feel like back then everybody thought, like, psychologists were German. That was always a thing for some reason. So I was like, damn, I haven't seen that in a long time. So it was funny seeing that. And he tried to at least get some help. He tried to take care of himself. And unfortunately, the psychologist was like, yeah, it's quick, dude. It'll take like 3 years. And the other day or some shit like that. And he's like, oh, fuck. Like, you could see in his face that he's like, I don't have that time. What if I hurt somebody else? Or what if I do something horrible again? Kind of thing. But yeah, that dude killed it. He deserves to be up there on that pedestal, as much as like Anthony Perkins is with Psycho and Norman Bates. Like, I really love this movie. I really dug it a lot. I'm glad I finally got around to it. But do you guys have any other things you noticed that really caught your attention by it?
I think for me, with you talking about that, and like, I think it's just like my... the intuition kind of thing of, like, nowadays that, sadly, you know, women like me have to have about these kind of guys, where, for me, he's untrustworthy on sight kind of thing. But I could definitely see, like, the charm that he has. But, you know, for me, being taught and stuff like that, it's like, no, that's something to you know, kind of like be on guard for. So yeah, like, but he definitely has like Dexter ish vibes, you know, and he definitely is like a one for one almost of like Dexter, and that voyeurism that in the Dexter show kind of shows. And
I very much do agree with that aspect, though, because now any person who sees this movie nowadays are going to be like, dude, he's fucking staring at us. We're having a party, and he's just fucking... There's a dude there. Like, me and my girlfriend were watching, and I immediately was like, oh, no. If some guy was peeking in, I'd call the cops like this immediately. Yeah. Or if it's a bunch of us guys, we're like, let's go kick this dude's ass.
Yeah. Also, he was offering her milk. That's a red flag. Anytime anybody drinks milk in a fucking movie, they're evil as shit.
Yes. Absolutely. I even said the same thing. I was like, milk... I was like, man, I love milk. I love chocolate milk. Why does it have to be like the devil's fucking liquid right? and shit. I'm like, no, why? Like, you know, A Clockwork Orange, you know, The Boys with Homelander, you know, Inglourious Basterds, everything, you know. I'm like, why? Why does it have to be milk? But yeah, he's like, I was like, you should have just, all right, whatever. Yeah, at that point, I was like, okay, dude, yeah, you're pretty fucked up. You're you know, that's what made me go, okay. You were sympathetic to me for a moment. You offered milk. You're fucking Satan. You're evil.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's why, like, for me, I just couldn't get past some things. And, like, it definitely is not a movie that could be believed and could be believable nowadays, definitely. Like, for example, like, her mother, his love interest mother, even though I'm pretty sure she, like, knew that he's hurt some, he's like not the greatest dude, but she's like willing to like just be careful and don't hurt my daughter, kind of, it essentially, that she's okay with it in a bit, or she's kind of just kind of crazy herself too. I mean, you know, blind woman kind of thing, back then, that kind of trope of a but yeah, like it's just something that's definitely like somewhat unbelievable to me, and like was something that contributed to kind of taking me out of the movie experience and stuff, that this woman would allow her daughter, still, like, even though sensing danger from this man, would still be like okay with her daughter kind of like going after him and
he stuff. Did cut him off at a certain point, though. I will at least say that for her.
He cut himself off.
Well, no, like, she's like, one of us is going to leave. Yeah, she's like, you got to, she's like, we're going to move out of here if you talk to my daughter again, pretty much is what she said, after she was like creep, like he almost murdered her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think she knew, but yeah.
I feel like the mom at first, I feel like the mom was like, weirdly enough, I feel like the mom wanted Helen. There you go. That's her name, Helen. To like get laid. I kept feeling having this. I feel like obviously there's like the pinup and the nude photo shoots and shit. But I feel like throughout the movie there was this underlying kind of like sexual nature where you know, like when he killed the stand-in who was like absolutely stunning. I'm not gonna lie. I had a huge crush on her watching this movie. She was super cute, and her dance. I was like, oh my god, she's adorable. But anyways. Yeah, like even her, I felt like, you know, they're kind of going backstage and they're going after hours, and like all I could think about, I was like, she wants to fuck. Like, I'm like, she's probably gonna fuck. And Mark is like, oh no, I have a completely different thing. And I felt like the mom in the beginning, she's like, I'm gonna finish my drink in 5 minutes. You should probably go up there and like talk to him. And I was like, you like trying to get your daughter laid? Like, you're really pushing that. But I feel like throughout the movie though, the mom, maybe because she's blind or something, her other senses got heightened, and that woman's intuition just got even more heightened. And the more she knew, because she even says it herself, she's like,
"Yeah,
I need information firsthand." And I feel like she knew until she finally confronts him. She's like, "Yeah, you're bad news. Mm-hmm. We can't be having this shit." Like, I think she was the one that was very level headed and no pun intended, but saw between the lines kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah
and then just one other thing, because you are asking like if we had any other thoughts, one other thing I was thinking of this movie, and it's a cliche about the whole show don't tell, but I think that this movie did that really well, whereas, you know, you could have this whole exposition where he's like, well, see, my dad used to throw lizards on me and stuff, but it's like, no, this is a movie about a guy who's a filmmaker. It's a film about a filmmaker. So we're going to show you that with, like, he shows you all these creepy videos from his childhood, and you see that his dad has these voyeuristic tendencies, and you get all of that info in a really neat way. And then he kind of goes out and he talks about his dad being academic, and then you see he's got like those like 18 volumes on like the nature of fear, and he just kind of like taps it for a second, and they comment on it a little, but they do more with the visual medium of film. They're like, we're going to show you these things, we don't need to have like a Chris Nolan like expository huge paragraph of explaining why he's this way, we can kind of give you these visual explanations. And I thought that was really well done.
I agree with that a lot, too, because one of my favorite parts, my girlfriend was kind of upset about it, but I thought it was fucking awesome, was that you don't see the victims' faces after they're dead, because there's a whole thing of like, you know, they you know, the stand-in when she's in the box, they never show it, and you know, it kind of makes the audience that they go, oh my god, her face is, you know, that's how she died terrified and frightened or whatever. And I love that aspect that they didn't show, because again, less is more, like you were saying. I in your head you kind of create the picture, and it's always more terrifying than it really is. So yeah, that's one of my big things that I loved about the less is more aspect. But yeah, his dad was kind of like a proto, well, I don't know if Scarecrow appeared by then, but he was a Jonathan Crane for sure, Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. You know, with all the books about fear, I was like, you might as well be the Batman villain. You know, you're already doing scumbag shit to your kid, but yeah.
So, Alan, I wanted to ask you, because you are like our resident horror film slasher film expert, and this gets described, as we touched on, as like a proto slasher. How do you think this was really influential on slashers, or how do you think it did kind of influence that genre?
Absolutely. I think it really did. I think Psycho and this film, I think, you know, filmmakers who got into it and probably started making slasher films
in the 70s, 80s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Halloween probably got that exactly, that POV kind of type of thing from it. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if John Carpenter like saw it as a kid and was like, damn, that's a really cool scene, you know. And now, you know, we have video games where you play as a serial killer, like Dead by Daylight, and you know, you stalk characters, and I think it's first person, I don't know, but there's you're pretty much doing the same thing. But absolutely, I feel like it is a big inspiration, because I feel like with the slasher villains, there's always something to them, and you know, they're almost kind of like superheroes in a way, where they have something that, you know, that you recognize, like Thor, he has his hammer, you know, Batman, you know, he's dressed like a bat essentially, and you know, you have the villains where like Freddy Krueger has his costume and the burnt face, and he has the claws, and with Mark's character, that was his thing, is the camera and the knife at the end of the tripod, where I was like, yeah, that's totally a slasher villain kind of thing. And just obviously the body count. I know this one had a very small body count compared to current slasher movies, where they're just trying to fucking bump up the numbers as much as they can. Where I did appreciate that this one, it was like, I think at most 3 people were killed, but that's enough to be like, yeah. And I'm pretty sure people later on were like, yeah, I wanted, they were influenced by that to, you know, Friday the 13th, let's kill as many fucking teenagers as we can and make them as horrifying as they can. But yeah, obviously, because of the time, they can't show gore and everything. I mean, there was like very minimal blood. I think like when Mark's character died, I think that was the only time you saw blood on his, you saw the blood on the blade, but it was so fucking minor, you can barely see it. But yeah, I really liked, I feel like a lot of slashers though nowadays don't incorporate as much as a good story, like origin story. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, yeah, you have Freddy Krueger, but like those stories are meant to show like how horrible this character is. Oh, well, you know what? Jason Voorhees, you know.
I was going to say, like, yeah, Jason with his childhood trauma too.
Exactly. So sometimes, like, even with Freddy versus Jason, they kind of made it seem where like Jason was quote unquote like the lesser of the two evils. Like, they're like, we want him to kill Freddy Krueger because Freddy Krueger for sure is evil as fuck. And they even do like a lot of lighting with colors where Jason has a lot of blues and Freddy has a lot of red. And yeah, like, even when the characters hear the story of Jason Voorhees, are kind of like, well, he doesn't seem that bad. Poor guy was fucking traumatized and just died in the lake and stuff. So yeah, damn, like, the more I think about it, yeah, there's just huge influences. Absolutely, yeah. But this one for sure, I feel like, deserves a lot more recognition, and I'm pretty sure the horror community like knows about it, but I hope like more current people that are getting into the genre can go out and see this movie and truly appreciate it for what it is.
And that just reminds me too, like, you know, the whole voyeuristic thing, and you know, it is touched on here, but I think that later slasher films would take that to the next level, because you always hear like the slasher movies, it's always like, don't have sex in a slasher movie because Jason or Freddy or whoever will kill. It's something they even comment on in like Cabin in the Woods, like, it's become such a trope. And I wonder if you can really trace that back to here with him being like, ooh, look at these people. You know, he doesn't murder anybody, but he is like kind of like drawn to them in that very voyeuristic Peeping Tom-esque way.
Yeah, and the same thing with like kind of the sex thing. I know nobody really had sex in this movie, but like one of the models, the pinup models, she was very kind of oozing sex appeal and everything. And a lot of current, you know, slashers from the 80s, a lot of the characters that were like kind of oozing that kind of like sexual appeal were the ones that ended up getting murdered. And I don't know. There's something about like characters that like have sex or they get naked or whatever the fuck, do drugs and drink and everything. There's just something about it. It's kind of like a punishment almost, where like the villain, the slasher villain, is going out of the way to be like, you're doing these horrible things. And even though they're not horrible, but like, it's their way of like, you know, you need to pay for your sins of, you know, doing this. Just how Jason, same thing. His mom in the original was like, I'm going to kill you fuckers because...
Fornicators.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they fucking were supposed to be taking care of this child, and they're like, nah, let's go fuck. Kind of thing. So it's like, you pay for what you've done. And I think in a way, Mark kind of did that in a sense with the pinup model, where he was like, you do these things, even though he's there taking the photos, which is kind of hypocritical, but yeah, I feel like in that sense that he's like, I need to kill you, I guess. Like, I felt like he needed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, ultimately, would you guys want to recommend this to anybody, or would you feel like you're kind of like, you know, like, I feel like it's pretty underrated for sure. I really hope people go out there and watch it and check it out. I mean, it's, I honestly, yeah, it still blows me away. For me personally, I thought it was really great. But Ariel, what do you think? Like, do you feel like you might need another watch, or you're like, nah, I'm good?
I'm definitely okay. But it's if you're looking for that kind of like, I guess, kind of scene where possibly things had inspiration from, I would recommend it. But if you know, I think. If you like Psycho, then probably check this one out. If you want like a more, or even like Dexter, if you want kind of like a more direct version of those kind of two characters, then check this one out. And yeah, it definitely is a movie of its time, and in the way that if a believability, I guess you can say, it's kind of like, yeah, like a psychological kind of thriller and case study essentially of a killer that, you know, wants to be caught and like has, what's that word, story laid out, and that's how it's gonna go, kind of thing. So yeah, if you are into those kind of thrillers, then definitely, yeah, then check this one out.
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely recommend this movie. I, like I said before, this didn't really know it, and it was, you know, brought to my attention, and I'm so glad, because as I've mentioned before on this series, and the big reason I wanted to do this vintage collection series is that I sometimes have a harder time with older movies because they were made so differently. It was such a different time, and finding things like this that really connect with me has been a mission for this, and this one definitely hit, and I think that it will connect with a lot of other people too. So yeah, of a lot of the things that I've watched for this, and then of course also our last week's pick, The Uninvited, I would really recommend both of them to, if you are like me and you want to look at some older films that are not going to be like on the AFI 100 list, or like, you know, Roger Ebert's great movies, or ones that are a little more kind of beneath the surface. This is a really great one for that.
Sweet, yeah. Well, no, thank you guys for watching. I hope you guys out there give it a shot. I mean, the Halloween season's coming right up, so if you're in that mood for like an old type of movie that you're like, hey, you know what, I don't want to watch Halloween, I want to go even further back, well, there you go.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and now our plugs.
Yeah, I host a podcast that comes out every first of the month called You've Never Seen, where I discuss a film that either myself or my guest has never seen, but is considered a part of pop culture, and cinematic history. The most recent one as of this recording was Harry Potter, which was a pretty fun one for me to do. Very much enjoyed it. And talking about it, I could always talk about Harry Potter. So yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And then I do a couple other podcasts as well. I've got Gateway Episodes, which is going to be coming out with season 2 pretty soon. We're waiting to hit a Patreon goal and I'm finishing recording the last couple episodes. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. That's where we watch a single episode of a TV show and decide if we want to step through the gateway and get into the show. I also co-host, speaking of Damien who recommended this, I do co-host his podcast, Can I Say Something? Have a lot of fun with that. And then whenever there's a new Marvel thing, I also do Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, which is our MCU podcast. And then speaking of our Patreon, we also do every once in a while a exclusive episode for our Undercast Film Club. So if you are a patron, you get to hear that. We're going to be talking about, I'm not sure if it's going to be out by the time this episode drops, the kind of summer movie recap. So looking at a lot of the movies that came out this past summer season. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So if you, you know, have as little as a dollar to spare, just $1 a month for our Patreon, and we'd love to have you. And we've got our Discord and you can check that out. Follow us on all the socials, Undercast Company everywhere. And we'd love to hear from you, get any episode suggestions, because we will sometimes cover them. We like to hear what you guys want us to cover, and we will maybe talk about it. So let us know.
Yeah, check out that Patreon. I'm in the process of developing kind of like a solo essay kind of series for the patrons that I'm getting very excited for. So it's in the early works, but a little bit of like a TED Talk kind of nerd talk kind of thing that doing a solo episodes on every once in a while. So yeah.
And I just want to mention, I am guesting on a lot of other podcasts that I've been having a really fun time with. Some I am very, very excited for you guys to hear, so definitely check all of those out. The one that I'm on that actually drops today, so you guys should just go listen to it right now, is I was on the Cozy Christmas podcast talking about the top 5 underrated Christmas movies. I had a ton of fun being on that, so go ahead and check that out. The link to that is just going to be in the description for the episode, so definitely give that a click.
Cool. And yeah, look out for the next Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, where we're going to do a 3-hour episode about She-Hulk and Meg Thee Stallion twerking, so look out for that. Hope you guys like it. Just kidding. But yeah,
right, thanks.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks for being amazing, everybody. Good night.
Take it easy, everybody.